Welcome to Bruderhof Radio, a bi-monthly program that seeks to broaden the boundaries of progressive thought and action. I'm your host, Andrew Zimmerman. Martine Espada, an English professor at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, has been engulfed with accolades over the past decade. His 6 volumes of poetry and 1 volume of nonfiction essays have won numerous awards, including an American Book Award in 1996. Espada has been called the Latino poet of his generation and perhaps the greatest political poet writing in the United States today. The New York Times Book Review, Harper's, and The Nation have all published his work. And yet, when you look beyond the hyperbole, you find a very down-to-earth poet, one who writes primarily about factory workers, illegal immigrants, poverty-stricken tenants, and death row inmates. What is it, then, that endears the gritty writing of the Brooklyn-born Espada to the highbrow literary world? Perhaps it is because, as the Penn Revson Foundation said in awarding him a prize in 1994, quote, his art gives dignity to the insulted and injured of the earth. Or perhaps it is the way Espada, who has held jobs ranging from bouncer to tenant lawyer, combines his working-class upbringing with his Puerto Rican heritage, infusing his poetry with rich social commentary, biting political satire, and a remarkable sense of history. Whatever it is, Espada's writing remains admired both critically and popularly, while still challenging our societal prejudices of race, class, and ethnicity. Today, on Bruderhof Radio, Martine Espada reads 6 of his poems and speaks about the issues that concern him most, such as discrimination against Latinos, the United States' attitude towards Puerto Rico, and how poetry and imagination must play an essential role in the struggle for justice and equality. Espada read these poems at a recent public reading at the State University of New York at New Paltz.
I think some of the publicity, some of the propaganda that went out for this reading stressed all the different jobs that I've had. I have had a lot of jobs. I was a bouncer in a bar. I was a night desk clerk in a flop house. I worked in a primate lab taking care of baby monkeys. Ooh, I'm the only poet you'll ever meet who's been bitten by a monkey. Yeah, I wrote a poem called Do Not Put Dead Monkeys in the Freezer. I won't read that one. But I will read this one. This is about having one foot in each of 2 different worlds. I worked in a printing plant. When I was a kid, I made legal pads by hand. And then I found myself a decade later in law school. It gives you a little bit of perspective. So this is really about not taking anybody's labor for granted. Somebody made everything we use, even this podium here. Who burns for the perfection of paper? At 16, I worked, after high school hours, at a printing plant that manufactured legal pads. Yellow paper stacked 7 feet high and leaning as I slipped cardboard between the pages, then brushed red glue up and down the stack. No gloves, fingertips required for the perfection of paper, smoothing the exact rectangle. Sluggish by 9 p.m., the hands would slide along suddenly sharp paper and gather slits thinner than the crevices of the skin, hidden. Then the glue would sting, hands oozing till both palms burned at the punch clock. 10 years later, in law school, I knew that every legal pad was glued with the sting of hidden cuts, that every open law book was a pair of hands upturned and burning. So I became a lawyer. It was easier than factory work. I worked first for an organization called META, in the Boston area, and we did bilingual education law, very unusual. We got a call one day from a place called Lynn, Massachusetts. Lynn is a factory town north of Boston, and now has a big Puerto Rican and Dominican population. We got a call from somebody, a parent in the Hispanic Parent Advisory Council, parents with the kids in the bilingual program, and she said, "Would you please come up to Lynn English High School?" And we said, "But why?" And she said, "They have just banned Spanish at lunchtime. You can't speak Spanish at lunchtime." Imagine trying to enforce that here. Yeah, people are getting indignant just thinking about it. Oh no! So anyway, we went over to the high school. We had to have a hearing with the principal, and we explained to him they had to read a document called the United States Constitution. And then we read it to him, and he had to change the policy, you know. But one of the great things, I should tell you this, one of the great things about being a poet is the opportunity for revenge. So I wrote this poem. It's called The New Bathroom Policy in English High School. The boys chatter Spanish in the bathroom while the principal listens from his stall. The only word he recognizes is his own name. And this constipates him. So he decides to ban Spanish in the bathrooms. Now he can relax. After I worked at Meta, I had another lawyer job in Boston. I worked as a supervisor of a program called Su Clínica Legal. Su Clínica Legal is a legal services program for low-income Spanish-speaking tenants in a city called Chelsea. Chelsea is a tough little town right across the Tobin Bridge from Boston. It's a gateway city, a city of immigrants, and now they come from Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, they come from Guatemala, El Salvador. They also come from Cambodia and from Vietnam. Poorest city in Massachusetts, poorest housing in Massachusetts, so there's a great need for legal services, and we did eviction defense, no heat cases, rats, roaches, crazy landlords. I'm going to read you a poem about my favorite case, and it doesn't have anything to do with going to court. It's not like Ally McBeal, you know. And I watch Ally McBeal, you know. Anyway, it's not like that. It's not like a debating society, you know. And sometimes things happen outside of the courtroom. The names have been changed to protect the guilty, and the rest of it is true. The poem is called Thieves of Light, Chelsea, Massachusetts, 1991. We all knew about Gus, the locksmith, the Edison man, and me. We heard about the welfare hotel where he stacked clothes on the sidewalk for the garbage truck if no rent was paid by Wednesday morning. We heard about the triple-deckers where he heaved someone else's chair or television from the third floor and raged like a drunk, blaming his woman till the pleading tenant agreed to leave. There was word he even shot a cop 20 years ago, but the jury knew Gus, too, studying cuticles or the courtroom clock, as the foreman said, not guilty. The only constable in Chelsea wore his gun in a shoulder holster due to cigarette at a dangerous angle, yet claimed that Gus could not be found on Broadway to serve a summons in his hand. This is how we knew Gus. Louisa saw the sludge plop from the faucet, the mice dropping from the ceiling, shook her head and said, no rent, still said no after his fist buckled the bolted door. In the basement, Gus hit switches, the electric arteries in the wall stopped pumping, stove cold heat off, light bulbs gray. She lived 3 months in darkness, the waxmer candles spreading over the kitchen table like a calendar of the constant night, sleeping in her coat, a beggar in the underworld kingdom of rodents. When Luisa came to me, a lawyer who knew Spanish, she kept coughing into her fist, apologizing with every cough. So, three strangers gathered in the hallway. The locksmith kneeled before the knob on the basement door because I asked him to be a burglar today. The Edison man swallowed dryly because I asked him to smuggle electricity today. Forget Gus's promise of crushed fingers. And me, the lawyer, tightly rolling a court order in my hand like a newspaper to swing at flies, so far from the leather-bound books of law school, the treatises on the constitution of some other country. We work quickly, thieves of light. The door popped open as in a dream of welcome swaying with the locksmith's fingers. The Edison man pressed his palms against the fuse boxes and awakened the sleeping wires in the walls. I kept watch by the door, then crept upstairs, past Gus's office with shadows and voices, drove the blood in my wrist still faster. I tapped on Luisa's door. I had to see if the light was on. She stared at me as if the rosary had brought me here with this sudden glow from the ceiling, a stove where rice and beans could simmer, sleep without a coat. I know there were no angels swimming in that dim yellow globe, but there was a light louder than Gus, so much light, I had to close my eyes. And here's a poem about my cousin Esteban. Actually, it's about this strange thing that happens on the East Coast. I still haven't figured out if it happens on the West Coast. This is a situation of the Mexican restaurant, which is owned by Anglos. And you walk in, and the hostess is Anglo, and the wait staff, all Anglo, and the bartender is Anglo. You're thinking, where the hell are the Mexicans? So the door, you know, the kitchen door swings open. They're the Mexicans, and the Salvadorans and the Puerto Ricans and so on. And very clear segregation. Very clear segregation. Very deliberate. Because I've seen it as a pattern. I've seen it a number of times. And I guess the idea is to try to serve non-threatening Mexican food. You know, make sure you aren't exposed to any Spanish while you're actually in the Mexican restaurant. But, you know, Jim Crow is back and, you know, alive and well in the Mexican restaurants. So this used to annoy me, you know, and then it infuriated me one day because something happened to my cousin Esteban, who used to work in a place like this and who wanted to be a waiter. So here's the poem that came out of it, which is the only good thing that came out of it. The poem is called "For the Jim Crow Mexican Restaurant in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where my cousin Esteban was forbidden to wait tables because he wears dreadlocks." I have noticed that the hostess in peasant dress, the wait staff and the boss share the complexion of a flour tortilla. I have spooked the servers at my table by trilling the word burrito. I am aware of your T-shirt solidarity with the refugees of the Americas since they steam in your kitchen. I know my cousin Esteban the sculptor rolled tortillas in your kitchen with the fingertips of ancestral Puerto Rican cigar makers. I understand he wanted to be a waiter, but you proclaim his black dreadlocks unclean, so he hissed in Spanish, and his apron collapsed on the floor. Me la migra handcuffed the waitstaff as suspected illegal aliens from Canada. May 100 mice die from the oven like diminutive leaping dolphins during your Board of Health inspection. May the kitchen workers strike, sitting with folded hands as enchiladas blacken and twisters of smoke panic the customers. May a Zapatista squadron commandeer the refrigerator, liberating a pillar of tortillas at gunpoint. May you hallucinate dreadlocks braided in thick vines around your ankles. And may the Aztec gods, pinned like butterflies to the menu, wait for you in the parking lot at midnight, demanding that you spell their names.
This is Bruderhof Radio. I'm Andrew Zimmerman. You're listening to Martin Espada, poet, activist, and lawyer. We'd like to hear from you if you've got questions or comments about today's program. Give us a call toll-free at 1-800-778-8461. That's 800-778-8461.
I want to go back to the island of Puerto Rico again, and I want to go back to something that happened there, Palm Sunday, 1937. It's so rare when Puerto Rico makes the news in this country. It certainly made the news that day. Palm Sunday, 1937. Nationalist Party, the Pro-Independence Party, had a demonstration in the coastal town of Ponce. And they were there commemorating the abolition of slavery, the anniversary of that, but also to protest the imprisonment of their leaders who've been rounded up and thrown into jail on charges of seditious conspiracy the year before. Some of you may have heard of a man named Pedro Albizu Campos. Right? That was the leader of the independence movement. He would spend about 30 years in prison because of that. At the last moment, the parade permit was revoked. They marched anyway, and then the police fired upon the crowd. And within a few minutes, 21 people were killed and about 200 people were wounded. What came to be known as La Masacre de Ponce, or the Ponce Massacre. And of course, I'm reflecting on that today in the wake of these arrests, about 140 people arrested in the island of Yeques and led away by the FBI and federal marshals, not just because they want the bombs to stop falling in Yeques and the people of Yeques to be left in peace, but because so many of them want their country to be independent. They want an independent Puerto Rico. That's what I want, too. So I'd like to read this poem now. It's a poem that takes as its point of departure the Ponce Massacre of 1937, which I always understood as abstract history. And then one day, a good friend of mine, Luis Cardenas Costa, told me a story about his mother, Nina, and Nina's fiancé, Beijing, and this Ponce Massacre, which suddenly gave the history a human face. And that's what we need to do with history, whether we're historians or poets. So here's the poem now. It's called Rebellion is the Circle of a Lover's Hands, Beijing and Nina. The marchers gathered, nationalists massed beneath the delicate white balconies of Marina Street. And the colonial governor pronounced the order with patrician calm. 50 years of family history says it was Beijing who dipped a finger into the bloody soup of their own body and scratched defiance in jagged wet letters on the sidewalk. Around him stormed the frenzied, clattering drumbeat of machine guns, the stampede of terrified limbs, and the panicked wail that rushed babbling past his dim senses. Palm Sunday, 1937. The news halted the circular motion of his lover's hands as she embroidered the wedding dress. She nodded, knew before she was told. Years later, with another family in a country of freezing spring rain called Nueva York, Nina is quietly nervous when her son speaks of rifles and a bullhorn shout, when coffins are again bobbing on the furious swell of hands and shoulders and the whip of nightsticks brings fresh blood stinging from the scalp. But rebellion is the circle of a lover's hands that must keep moving, always weaving. This is a poem that I typically finish my readings with. It's the title poem of the book, Imagine the Angels of Bread. And the premise of this poem is very simple. What if this were the year that justice was finally done? What if this were the year that justice was finally done? The meek shall inherit. Now. Well, okay. I know the change doesn't happen overnight. I also know that no change for the good ever happens without being imagined first. Even if at the time we imagine this great change, it seems hopeless or impossible, because history teaches us otherwise, and teaches us, too, that we're the ones who make it happen. It doesn't come from the White House. It comes from our house. Right? And it begins with this political imagination. So the poem departs from that, a series of reversals. The one that was on the bottom is on the top and vice versa, and goes on from there. But I can't imagine by myself, so I ask you to imagine with me. The poem is called Imagine the Angels of Bread, and I'll finish with this. This is the year that squatters evict landlords, gazing like admirals from the rail of the roof deck or levitating hands in praise of steam in the shower. This is the year that shawled refugees deport judges who stare at the floor and their swollen feet as files a stamp of their destination. This is the year that police revolvers stow hot, blister the fingers of raging cops and nightsticks splinter in their palms. This is the year that dark-skinned men lynched a century ago return to sip coffee quietly with the apologizing descendants of their executioners. This is the year that those who swim the border's undertow and shiver in boxcars are greeted with trumpets and drums at the first railroad crossing on the other side. This is the year that the hands pulling tomatoes from the vine uproot the deed to the earth that sprouts the vine, the hands canning tomatoes and naming the will that owns the bedlam of the cannery. This is the year that the eyes stinging from the poison that purifies toilets awaken at last to the sight of a rooster-loud hillside pilgrimage of immigrant birth. This is the year that cockroaches become extinct. that no doctor finds a roach embedded in the ear of an infant. This is the year that the food stamps of adolescent mothers are auctioned like gold doubloons, and no coin is given to buy machetes for the next bouquet of severed heads in coffee plantation country. If the abolition of slave manacles began as a vision of hands without manacles, then this is the year. If the shutdown of extermination camps began as imagination of a land without barbed wire or the crematorium, then this is the year. If every rebellion begins with the idea that conquerors on horseback are not many-legged gods, that they too drown if plunged in the river, then this is the year. So may every humiliated mouth, teeth like desecrated headstones, fill with the angels of bread. Thank you.
In addition to reading his poetry, Martin Espada spoke with Bruderhof Radio about the power of poetry to inspire action and foment social change.
The last poem you read, Imagine the Angels of Bread, is speaking of the day, envisioning, you know, the day when justice will happen. I'm wondering how you see an evening like this where you kind of, you know, you're working through some of your poetry and you're talking about your experiences, how you see, you know, an event like this possibly working towards that. Are you looking maybe to radicalize a few students? Do you see your poetry as propaganda?
Well, I see what I do as being a small piece of a much larger project. Certainly, I can't tell you what kind of consequences the poems have. I can't pin that down. I can't predict that. What I do know, as a professor of mine, Herbert Hill, used to say, is that ideas have consequences. Ideas have consequences. We know that ideas have consequences. If we see the way that people in power act as if they believe that ideas have consequences, look at the way that people who hold power, for example, try to manipulate the rest of us to act against our own interests. Right? They know that ideas have consequences. And what I'm doing here, ideally, is putting out some ideas that ultimately will have some consequences. Will I radicalize some students? I hope so. That's how it begins sometimes, for a student who's never been to a poetry reading before, or has never heard someone like me with openly leftist ideas express those ideas before. This is a new experience for many students, and I'm trying to reach them not simply as someone who is expressing political ideas, but as someone who's writing poetry. And the notion here is to use poetry, among other purposes, to move people. And as another writer friend of mine is fond of saying, if you move people, if you change their hearts, they will find a way to rationalize that, and then they change their minds. In other words, the heart comes first, then the head. Right? So if I can make people feel a certain way, if I can move them, they will begin to think. If their hearts go in a certain direction, their minds will follow.
As evidenced by his poetry, Espada questions the United States' continued presence on the island of Puerto Rico, and he uses his poetry to expose what he sees as the political and cultural colonization of his people. Espada is particularly concerned with the situation in Vieques, a small island off the coast of Puerto Rico that is used by the U.S. Navy as a bombing range, even though it remains inhabited. Recently, Vieques has been the site of large nonviolent protests against the United States military. We asked Espada about his attitude to Puerto Rican independence.
Well, I've always found it ironic that this country, which, as you point out, itself was colonized, and which had a revolution to break free of the colonizer, Great Britain, would deny the same rights of political democracy and resistance to Puerto Rico. Having said that, there are many observers who feel that the only alternative will be some kind of violent uprising. Pedro Albizu Campos, who was the leader of the Puerto Rican independence movement in the 30s, 40s, and 50s, who spent most of those years in prison for so-called seditious conspiracy, used to say, and I'm paraphrasing now, that the United States is a very big country, and there's no reason for the United States to pay any attention to us unless we, as he used to put it, open their ears with bullets. You know, we're going to have to make a big noise if the United States is going to give a damn about what Puerto Rico wants or does. My own father has expressed very angrily his notion that the only way this island is ever going to be independent is with, as he puts it, 3 inches of blood in the streets. Having said that, I think that would be obviously a last alternative. And I think clearly a trauma for the island of Puerto Rico. It may be a necessary trauma at some point, but I hope that it doesn't come to that. I believe that it is still possible for a peaceful transition to take place where the island of Puerto Rico can become independent. It takes a recognition on the part of the United States that reparations are due to Puerto Rico. And we see all those colonial contradictions coming to a head now in the case of Vieques, where people have clearly said no, no more. One man, yes, was killed by a stray bomb, but where the cancer rate is 27% higher than the rest of Puerto Rico because of all the poisons dropped there by the Navy, most recently depleted uranium, where a professor of geography has studied the eastern third of the island and concluded that there are more craters per kilometer there than the moon, where there is a 40% unemployment and more than 70% of the people live below the poverty line. Since the bombing by the Navy has destroyed the coral reef and therefore the fishing industry upon which those people depended for their livelihood. All of that is related to the problem of colonialism. And yet, if you notice, the way that this problem was addressed in Vieques was peacefully. That was essentially a pacifist movement that where people came in and occupied that island for more than a year and said no to the Navy, but said no peacefully. And it really bewildered the Navy because colonized people don't say no. Colonized people are conditioned to say yes. All right, but they said no, and they said no with their bodies, which is all they had. Let's not forget that after the Second World War, the European powers such as Great Britain divested themselves of many of their colonies. Decolonization happens in this world. It has been happening for half a century as the European powers have let go of their colonies in the Third World. And it's time for the United States to do the same with Puerto Rico and stop making the argument that it's impossible, because that argument is dishonest and immoral.
That's all for this edition of Bruderhof Radio, a poetry reading and interview with renowned Latino poet Martin Espada. Espada's 6 volumes of poetry and 1 volume of essays are available in most bookstores. This program was produced by Andrew Zimmerman with assistance from Ben Wright. Bruderhof Radio is a production of the Bruderhof Communities, a communal movement based on Christ's Sermon on the Mount, in particular the teachings concerning brotherly love and love of enemies, mutual service, nonviolence, and the refusal to bear arms. Money and possessions are pooled voluntarily, and in turn each member is provided for and cared for. For more information about the Bruderhof Communities and Bruderhof Radio, call 1-800-778-8461. Again, that's 800-778-8461.